Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Ohio Congressman Tim Ryan is seeking the Democratic nomination for president in 2020, joining a long and historically diverse field of candidates. He told the hosts of the ABC morning show The View last week that he could unseat President Trump.
I'm just going to be myself. I'm going to be for the things I've always been for. And I think that most progressives are going to see that as a candidate that can not only advance a progressive agenda, but also win. I can win Western PA. I can win Ohio. I can win Michigan. I can win Wisconsin. And that means Donald Trump is going back to Mar-a-Lago full time.
It's time for our weekly reporter roundtable. Joining us is Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Andy Chow. Welcome back.
Good morning.
And Cincinnati Enquirer Columbus Bureau Chief Jackie Borchardt. Welcome back.
Good morning.
And Columbus Dispatch State House reporter Jim Siegel. Welcome back.
Good to be here.
We'll be getting a primer on the education funding proposal by Jim. Not proposal by Jim, but we'll get a primer with Jim on that later on in the program. So Tim Ryan is running for president. Ohio has somebody on the Democratic primary ticket so far. What do we know about him? You guys don't cover him, but he has been in the Ohio General Assembly.
Well, he was only in the General Assembly for 2 years, and then he won the seat in Congress up in Northeast Ohio, the 13th Congressional District, which was Jim Traficant's district. He was a Traficant aide. That's kind of how he got his start. And so he's been in Congress since 2003. And, you know, Tim Ryan's kind of an interesting politician. He's been in that seat's been relatively safe for him. And so he's been able to, over the years, propose maybe, you know, mull other opportunities like running for Senate or governor or now president, which
he's
he was talking about last
before.
Year. Right. He's always said, you know, I'm considering or I'm seriously considering and, you know, that it ever materializes. So that's always been kind of the what you need to know about Tim Ryan's larger political ambitions. And so I think some people were surprised last week that he actually officially said, I am running.
It was also a little surprising because we've been following Sherrod Brown, the Ohio's U.S. Democratic senator. But he had more of an exploratory committee. He went on a tour of the early presidential primary states, and then he ultimately decided to not run. But there was a lot of chatter around Sherrod Brown, whereas with Tim Ryan, it was I don't think it was as much on people's radar. And then all of a sudden, oh, hey, yeah, I am going to run. And like Jackie said, he built a reputation of being the guy who almost ran for things and never did. We thought that he might have run for governor last year and decided not to. I also think that Speaker of the U.S. House. He considered running as Speaker or Minority Leader of the U.S. House.
Against Nancy Pelosi.
And then never really made that official. So I think he's also sort of built this base of people who, if they do know Tim Ryan, he is somebody who's very attractive to them politically. They think that, oh, yeah, he's with me when it comes to labor issues. But then can also be with me on some social issues as well. He's from the Mahoning area where we've talked about that. That the Mahoning Valley area of Ohio is sort of a good litmus test for politicians who can maybe win areas, blue collar areas that used to be Democratic strongholds that aren't quite that way anymore because of Donald Trump.
Someone suggested on Columbus on the Record last week that on Sunday that this is just his way of beefing up his resume because that congressional district's going to take a hit in the next redistricting.
I had heard that from some Democrats. You know, Ohio is set to lose a seat in the next redistricting, and that would be that area in the last election swung very hard toward President Trump and toward Republicans. And while he won, it was by a much smaller margin than in previous years. And so that area seems like with the, you know, political makeup maybe shifting a little bit, that would be a prime area to remove a district and kind of move some things around.
And they're saying add one in Cincinnati.
Yeah, I think some of the talk is, I mean, Cincinnati, Hamilton County has trended more Democratic in recent elections than it was say, in 2010 in the last census. Mm-hmm. And so it would make sense to put a Democratic seat down there, to draw a district that tends to lean that way down there. I don't know. It's really it's going to be an education, I think, for all of us when we go through this new process.
What those whippersnappers will do once they get a hold of the redistricting pencil.
Well, there's new rules. There's right. Whatever happens in this, federal court case challenging the maps we have now could weigh in and have a say in what we do in 2021.
Yeah, I mean, Tim Ryan's current district, if you were to look at it, it looks like a puzzle piece. The way it's shaped, and the next district, and it's shaped that way because the Republicans were trying to carve as many Democrats as possible into his district so that they could form up a few other safe Republican seats up in Northeast Ohio. Mm-hmm. Now again, the demographics are shifting in terms of, it's getting redder up there, and right. With the new rules on the new redistricting, it's very possible that that seat is not going to be as safe for him coming up as it is now. And I think he knows that. Look, mm-hmm. he's a smart guy. Mm-hmm. And so he is. I definitely do think this is part of what he's doing here, is sort of getting his name out there and making sure that he has a place to go. And frankly, if you're the Democratic Party, that's not a bad thing for them. I mean, he is a articulate, smart, he's pretty smart. He's a progressive, but he also has some
The blue collar
background. Yeah. He doesn't like NAFTA. He supported the renegotiation of NAFTA, and he does have the ability to speak to some of these blue collar workers, kind of like Sherrod Brown when he was running, or not running, whatever you want to call
right.
it. And so he's a guy if you're the Democrats, you don't want Tim Ryan to go away, but he will have a tougher time, I think, regardless of what him and what he does if he runs again in come 2022.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'll have to see. Now the question, now when you played that clip, they weren't asking, the question wasn't answered correctly in that he could argue that I can send Donald Trump back to Mar-a-Lago, but that's not the question. The question isn't, can you beat Donald Trump? The question is, can you beat the 15 other Democrats
right.
currently
because
in the field,
most
of whom have more money and name recognition than you do?
Yeah, he's not running for president yet. He's just running for the Democratic nomination. I keep trying to tell people
that. Yeah.
That's a huge
hurdle.
So he's
a long way off from facing Donald Trump.
And what he's really running for at this point is a seat at that first debate in June.
Are they drawing straws for that kind of a thing? Is it?
They are. You have to meet certain criteria. Yeah. So, in the past, that's usually been determined by poll numbers. Yeah. And the Democrats this year have a criteria set out where you need to, I think it's raise 65,000 contributions from, I think it's at least 200 individuals across 20 states. So you need to show you've got some kind of broad appeal and support throughout the country.
Mm-hmm.
Tim Ryan does have a pretty broad
base. He knows people across
the country. Yeah. If you look at his financial contributions, as I did late last week, you can see that he gets contributions from almost all 50 states. And he does have a lot of, his biggest supporters are your traditional labor unions and PACs of that nature, but also a lot of, large individual contributions. The challenge for him is going to be, I think, we've seen with the Democratic primary so far, the importance of these small contributions, these small dollar amounts from a lot of people. That's how, like, Bernie Sanders, raises a lot of money. And there's mm-hmm. this pressure on Democratic candidates to not take PAC money, not take corporate, PAC money. And that's been a great source for Tim Ryan's past fundraising efforts. So,
Are you guys looking forward to the debates?
Oh,
well,
I thought we just finished this. I thought we just had debates.
I like debates. I don't like melees that involve 10 people.
Right.
Those aren't debates. That's just, I don't know what you want to call it. That's
even
just,
the debates are barely debates anymore.
Right.
But
that's just a television spectacle. It's not even a debate. You don't even, how are you supposed to learn anything with that many people on a stage?
But how would you otherwise get the same? I mean, there is something that you learn. You learn how they respond to, rejection, how they respond to their protests when they're not getting enough airtime. That kind of, I don't know. It's interesting to watch, but I agree. As far as substance goes,
it's also
kind of useless.
It can also point out, that person's not really good on camera. That person's not really good when the spotlight's on them, but maybe they are still a good you know, executive, a good leader, government official. I think the other thing is, and I of course, this is going to be the obvious problem for the any Democrat running for the nomination, is that the whole Donald Trump factor, where I think a lot of Democrats want to just focus on the fact that they want to beat Donald Trump, and they might get distracted from actually talking about issues. And so that first debate, I'm sure the very first question of that first debate is going to be about Donald Trump, and maybe not so much about a lot of the issues surrounding Donald Trump in the White House. And so I think that's going to be a big thing, not necessarily to win over Democrats, because I think Democrats who call themselves Democrats want to hear sort of Trump bashing. But there's a huge group of people in the middle, those moderates who could swing towards Donald Trump, or who could swing towards more of a moderate Democrat, who maybe don't want to hear Trump bashing and want to hear more about labor issues. And that's where Tim Ryan might shine.
The challenge is, when you have 10 people on a stage, you're not really going to get much about issues.
Right. Mm-hmm.
It's really, you know, it's an opportunity for the candidates to get like one or two good one-liners in, or you know, strong statements that will resonate with the audience. They want to show you know, viewers that, hey, I've got potential to go forward, and I need your support. And that's kind of what Tim Ryan would need going forward. He would need to get to that debate stage, first of all. He would need then to, you know, have something memorable, something newsworthy come out of that debate, which is possible the way that they're doing it, because they aren't going to have a second tier debate. They're going to then at that point draw straws, like you said. So you have two nights of primetime debates that you would hope then that people would watch both if they're interested. But that's kind of what they need then to get the support to keep going forward.
Interesting. Moving on. Governor DeWine signed the bill increasing the gas tax. He did not take any, you know, do any line item vetoing of it. You know, there are a lot of other interesting things about that transportation bill besides the gas tax. But it was well below what he called the bare bones ask of 18 cents a gallon. Basically, what the Republican-controlled General Assembly has done is go with short-term planning versus long-term planning.
Right. The governor, you know, was really, really pushing for 18 cents, and they used some pretty strong language around that ask. You know, people are going to die. This is the bare minimum, absolute bare minimum we need to keep people safe. And what the administration was really talking about was, this is what we need for about 10 years of these kind of safety improvement projects, expansion projects. And what was finally approved, the 10.5 cents plus the 19 cents on diesel, is about like a 4 to 6 year project timeline. And those projects have not yet been decided. That's kind of the next step.
And so the Speaker Larry Householder pointed out that a big part of the bill was also a committee that was going to form a task force to research driving habits. Yeah, because this is what we need,
more
task force.
Yeah, it's not over until you have a study committee to keep it going.
But, you know, so let me back up and say that an interesting debate that was being had on all of this that went with the fuel tax issue was how to charge electric vehicles and hybrids. Yeah. So if they use less fuel, then how do you get some revenue from the use of those cars? So they created, I think it was a $200 fee for electric vehicles and a $100 fee for hybrid vehicles
per year. That was pretty tough. I was surprised they went that high.
And so the discussion was, well, is that arbitrary? Where do we come up with those numbers? What is the impact on EVs and hybrids on the road? So this task force that Speaker Householder mentioned wants to look into how are the roads being used, what kind of, you know, motor vehicle development and technology is going to happen over the course of the next couple of years, and how is that going to impact the state of the roadways in the future?
We are going to return after a moment. We are talking with our weekly reporter roundtable today, Jackie Borchardt of the Cincinnati Inquirer, Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch, and Andy Chow of the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Questions or comments, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
WOSU Public Media's newest podcast series, Rivet, young people share their unique pathways to professional success. Listen to This American Graduate Project. Find Rivet now in WOSU's mobile app or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us is Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Andy Chow, Columbus Dispatch State House reporter Jim Siegel, and Cincinnati Enquirer Columbus Bureau Chief Jackie Borchardt. Do we really need to say anything more about the gas tax?
What more would you like to say?
Nothing.
It'll start in July.
And, you know, the price that you see at the pump right now already reflects the tax. So it'll just be you won't really see a difference other than it'll be higher because of the state tax.
Yeah. But we can just pretend that OPEC just did something.
Right.
Yeah. OK.
Oh, yeah. Well, you will note that there's now going to be a sticker on your fuel pump. Thanks to your friends in the Ohio Senate, they're going to put a sticker on the pump that says just how much tax you're paying on the gallon of gas.
Well, they fully want to take credit for this then.
Yeah.
And I think your friendly senator.
And I heard this from somebody that each county auditor gets to decide what that sticker looks like.
Oh,
well, there's parameters in the bill.
Yeah.
Oh, my goodness.
But they do have a little leeway as to like whether they make it blue or red.
It can only be red, white, or blue.
Of course.
Right.
Yes. So yeah, so you will see it, but
I think I've rolled my eyes like three times.
So you might see like local county auditors try to add whatever spin they can within those parameters.
Yeah,
all
I know is last week I think this happened across the county. I literally saw gas prices jump 50 cents in one day, early last week. So yeah. And there was no gas tax hike that caused that.
Yeah, don't blame the gas tax.
July. In July, you can.
That's what I was thinking. Any given day, it can go up 10.5 cents without.
Yeah,
the help
it does
of
anyways.
Them.
Yeah. But you can't blame this latest hike on those tax and spenders in the Ohio General Assembly. Okay. This is federal, but it affects Lake Erie. Senator Sherrod Brown has criticized the Trump administration for proposing a 90% cut to Great Lakes restoration funds. Here's what he said.
There's nobody that I see in this White House that stands up for safe drinking water or clean air. There's nobody that stands up for preserving wilderness. There's nobody that stands up to take on one of the most important moral issues of our time, climate change.
Yep. There's nobody.
Well, and so...
What in the world?
So this has actually been a trend of the Trump White House ever since he took office. When he proposes his budget, he has proposed a massive cut to the GLRI, the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative.
Yeah.
And every single time Senator Rob Portman from Ohio, Sherrod Brown, who you just heard from, the members of Congress from Ohio, they all call out and say, hey, stop it. Give us that money back. Put that money. It's very important.
Because they have members from Michigan, Wisconsin.
Exactly.
All the
states that Donald Trump won.
And they all like to drink water.
Yeah. And so
we have the freshest, largest fresh water.
It's been an interesting tactic to just propose such a huge cut to only reverse each time to fully fund that program. Senator Portman pointed out that this is a fund that's always sort of played with in the budget, that President Barack Obama also proposed a cut at one point, but not as extravagant as Donald Trump has. Now, the interesting thing is, that 90% cut is still reflected in the official budget. So the Trump administration is still proposing, you know, cutting that by $270 million and only giving the Great Lakes $30 million. Even though the president did tell a rally in Michigan a couple weeks ago that he would fully restore it. So that fund is sort of in play. Yeah, in play right now. But what Sherrod Brown was saying is that this is sort of an indication of a much larger problem with the administration, which has made a reputation of cutting back a lot of environmental regulations. There's also regulations in play right now, that federal regulations that help keep streams clean, that helps keep pollution out of streams that the Trump administration has proposed in cutting as well. So this has been, a continuing problem for environmental advocates.
Yeah, I mean, the EPA is run right now by Andrew Wheeler, who has very close ties to the coal industry. And generally conservatives are not big on business regulations, and that includes environmental regulations that they feel are onerous. It's not a surprise, I guess, that they're trying to scale some of this back, but not to the degree that I think even Republicans in Congress are surprised at some points by the amount of scaling back that the Trump administration is trying to do.
And it's counter to what Mike DeWine here as Ohio's governor is trying to do. He's proposing putting more money into Lake Erie and setting aside a fund over the next 10 years that will just pump millions of dollars to make sure that Ohio's waterways are clean. So it's sort of counterintuitive to what Ohio's top Republican is doing compared to the nation's top Republican.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's our weekly reporter roundtable. You just heard Andy Chow from the Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau. Also with us, Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch and Jackie Borchardt of the Cincinnati Enquirer. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. And you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Jim Siegel, you had a big honking article in the paper today about the education funding proposal put forth it's a bipartisan proposal, and one of the issues, one of the glaring issues of the whole proposal is that largely wealthy suburban districts are getting pretty good hikes in funding by this proposal, whereas poorer urban and rural districts are not. So how does that resolve? Where's that coming from, and what do people need to know?
Well, it comes from several reasons for that. One of them is that how the current formula works, and that a number of suburban districts under the current formula have not seen their funding growth go up very much, and they've been capped on that growth, and they haven't had a lot of some of them have had large enrollment increases, but their funding hasn't kept pace. Well, this formula is designed to take the caps off, and so when you do that, those districts sort of get, it sort of lets the steam out, and that's kind of what you're seeing here in some respects. And so that's part of the reason they're getting so much of the new money. Now, if you look at the total amount they're getting per pupil, they're still getting less than urban districts. They're still getting less than these rural poor districts per pupil. However, the increase that they're getting is significantly higher in this budget. And so that's part of it. And there's a number of other factors, but I kind of lost my train of thought there. The urban districts, the current formula, when determining how much money a local district should be paying for its own schools, they use a factor, they use property values, and income, and mix that together and try to come up with your state, your local share, of what you should be paying. Well, they've kind of recalculated that, and most agree it's a better way that they're trying to do it in this new Cutt-Patterson plan. However, what they're doing is they're separating out the charter school kids and the kids going to private school through vouchers, and so those kids are no longer included in the calculation of your local share, and therefore you look wealthier. If 20,000 Columbus students are no longer counted in as part of your local share, and you take them out because they're going to charter schools or private schools, well, now you're dividing your local property wealth and your local income by fewer students, and that'll produce a bigger number. So, for example, Youngstown Schools, which is also under state control because of its poor performance, Youngstown Schools under the current formula is the poorest district in the state. Under this new formula, they would be 94th. So they would move. I mean, that's how far they would slide.
Wow.
Because if you pull out all those charter school students, and there's a lot of them in Youngstown, then they have a lot less population to count.
And the purpose is that local funding doesn't go toward that, just state funding. So they just pull it out?
Trying to separate out charter school funding in general from the local schools, which they haven't quite figured out how they're going to do that yet, but that's what they want to do. But at the end of the day, it just makes some districts look wealthier, particularly a lot of the urban districts, because that's where a lot of the charter school students are. They look wealthier, and so they get, the formula thinks they should be paying for more of their own funding. And there's argument to be made that makes sense. However, the problem always is with school funding is that you can't just start from zero. You always have to base it off of what you're getting now, because those schools are currently using the current funding amount to pay for their schools. And so you always have that as a starting point, and that's where it can get difficult.
What do you see as the challenges in terms of getting something like this through the Ohio General Assembly? Are we just at the very, very beginning starting point now, and there's years to go, months to go? What is there any sense about the strategy going forward?
Well, I think optimists will tell you that they're going to try to get it passed and implemented for this budget. But that's an optimist. But I think the things going for them is that this new formula was proposed by Representative Bob Kupp, a Republican, and Representative John Patterson, a Democrat. They did what we all love to see, those task forces. and they came up with this plan. So a couple of the talking points is that they've been talking about this for a while. So there's been a lot of thought put into it, and it's a bipartisan deal. The problem is that it just asks for more money. It asks for more money than what even the DeWine proposal is. And I think that's where a lot of people are going to get tripped up. You are seeing different school groups coming out for it. The Ohio Association of School Business Officials is for it. That's the group that represents, school treasurers and local officials like that. But again, something against it is this issue with urban schools and lower income schools, where they aren't necessarily getting more funding, even though every year we see reports with data used through the school report cards that lower income schools and the students at those lower income schools are lagging behind in achievement compared to middle and.
I don't know if it was Representative Patterson or Representative Kupp, or somebody else said yes, but is it clear that lower funding is the reason why they have the lower, achievement levels?
That is one of the big questions is if it is this, then is it because of that? So they are finding that the achievement is lower in the lower income schools. But is it because they're lower income, or are there other factors? Which, of course, there are other factors in play there. So,
I mean, two big differences with this plan that kind of puts it on a better probably outcome than the past attempts at this. And the first is that it involved a lot of these school treasurers and superintendents on the front end to craft it. And so, but by already having the support of many of those folks, that puts it already in a better position. And then the second thing, I think, is it actually, tried to determine the cost of educating a student, which what we've been operating under for the past 10 years has just been we have X amount of money, and we're going to try to divide it up as fairly as possible. Where this actually says, look, you have how many students in a school, so you need how many teachers, and you plug in your student population, and boom, you get this per student funding number. The problem, I think, always was going to be, how do you determine that wealth factor? How do you determine how much Columbus City Schools can afford to pay toward that cost versus New Albany, for example? And so I think what you're still hearing a lot of support for this idea, for this concept, for most of it, just kind of some concerns to make sure that you don't see the big drop-offs in some of those districts, and that you make sure that it really is a true reflection of their wealth or their ability to pay.
Yeah, because you're right. One of the arguments for this is that it actually is based on something. It's not just, it's not just a number thrown out. I mean, literally the number out there right now for base cost per pupil is nothing more than like $10 more than it was the year before. That's the only basis for it.
That it's based on something, that they do try to go a long way in defining what it costs to educate a child in Ohio, is why Bill Phyllis is supporting this.
Yes. Well, and there's, yeah, I mean, it, it, it's a good way, when you think about it logically, it's a good way to fund schools. It's, hey, let's actually figure out what it costs and then fund that. The problem has always been
funding it.
The funding part of it. Yeah. I mean, Ted Strickland tried this, you know, 8-10 years ago, and he ran into the problem of actually having to fund it. And then when Kasich got into office, he threw the whole thing out.
Mm-hmm. And the other, I think, plus, and the reason why you're seeing some of these like school financial officers really backing it is by basing it off some sort of, you know, calculated per pupil cost, it does build some stability into the formula so that you can plan out, you know, your budget for several years. And it's also that per pupil, the pupil number, the student number, your population is an average. So if you do have a big population swing, one year for some reason, you're not going to lose a ton of money the next year. It's averaged out so that you can have some stability because, you always got to keep the lights on. There's some basic services that you're always going to need to have,
regardless.
Right. And if you look, but the issue as we kind of started off talking about, I mean, of all the districts where they have student poverty of at least 60%, 60% or more student poverty, those districts under this plan would get about $280 per pupil more, which is about 4.2% increase. All the districts that have less than 15% poverty would get an average of $392 per pupil more. That's $112 more than the highest poverty districts, and that's an increase of 22%. So I understand. You know, you can certainly make the argument that this formula makes a lot of sense on a lot of levels. But there's a lot of lawmakers, including the House Speaker and some others, who are looking at this, going, you know what? I look at the districts in my rural area, and I see what kind of what kind of programming they're able to offer, and the kind of grades they get on the state report card. And then I look at the districts in the suburban Franklin County, and I see they're getting a lot more money extra than.
But isn't
than mine.
That just a first year phenomenon or a first 2 year phenomenon? That's going
That'll
forward.
Be, well, it, it's okay. Phased in over 4 years, so it'll be a first 4 year phenomenon, and it's. You know, many will argue that the number one problem with education right now is the poverty achievement gap. It's persistent. It's vast. And frankly, you just look at the report cards, and you can almost pick every school's grades on the report cards based on the percentage of poverty in their districts. I mean, and it runs on a very linear graph, and most people say until we fix that. Then we're going to have problems, and that's why when they look at these numbers, there's concern about it. There's other funding they also want to do, which isn't even in this, which includes preschool for all 4-year-olds. And I know Mike DeWine has talked about that as well. He's wanting to do it, and it's kind of a separate agency. But so this isn't even all the money. This is $1.1 billion more money over 2 years. That lawmakers would have to come up with, and we haven't even gotten to the all day or preschool for 4-year-olds, nor have we funded any of the charter schools yet, because this plan does not yet have the charter school money.
So I do think that the makeup of the General Assembly and of the governor's office at this point in time might be uniquely positioned to take on this issue, where we're still 3 years off from the next gubernatorial race. We're 2 years off from the next legislative re-elections.
They're going to get it done,
if they're going to get it done, this might be
primo time to get something big done.
We have a House Speaker who's a Republican, but half of his votes came from the Democrats. There's just sort of been the spirit of collaboration. We saw that with the gas tax at the end, even though it wasn't as much as what DeWine wanted. So I do wonder if a lot of legislators are saying, we've been dealing with this issue for so long, we've been talking about it for so long, we have to face questions from our local school districts every year, every 2 years on this issue. Maybe this is the time to all get together and have the political will to get something done.
We shall see. We will be right back. This is our weekly reporter roundtable. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Thank you. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher, and it is our weekly reporter roundtable. Still with us, Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau reporter Andy Chow, Cincinnati Enquirer, Columbus Bureau Chief Jackie Borchardt, and Columbus Dispatch State House reporter Jim Siegel. Questions or comments, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And let's see. Hi, is it Setsy?
It's Betsy.
Betsy.
Yes.
In Delaware. Sorry.
Yes.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Actually, I think that the Finnish model is a good model for elementary school children. They start at the age of 7. And I think starting them too early is a mistake. I can see if it's a poverty level situation and you're trying to get food into a child. Mm. But I think the United States, this time on task and taking away recess, and I have my master's in art education. And I think that we need more socialization in school, more downtime. Mm. And I do think they should start later.
Okay. Are they having that debate in the Ohio General Assembly? I mean, is that something they're talking about?
Not when it comes to beginning enrollment, so maybe like, you know, starting first grade later or anything like that. There's been another debate about whether, like, the school year should be shorter. And every once in a while you hear somebody talk about year-round school. But that's more of a school year-to-school year debate and less of the overall when should it start? Well, when should a student start?
The Cupp-Patterson school funding model does want to provide preschool for four-year-olds from low-income families. They just hadn't worked out the details of that, what would be considered low-income and how would you fund it and how would you set up the programs that you could actually serve the kids efficiently. But that is something that they want to make sure that that's covered for at least for that population of children.
Go ahead.
I was going to say the Finnish education model is interesting. I mean, it is such a laid back education system compared to the United States and the way we do things here. They don't have standardized testing. They do start later. They go to school later in the day. Then, you know, we don't force them on the bus at 6:30 in the morning like we do here. But I mean, the question, of course, is what are those kids like when they start? And that's always the question. And I don't know that there is such – I don't think there's nearly the disparity in Finland of income and you know, parental education and all those things that causes the problems in the United States. Not that the United States and Ohio couldn't benefit from some significant overhauls in the way we do schools and the way we do our school calendar. I mean, does anyone really think anymore that a 3-month summer off is beneficial to the education system anymore? Mm-hmm. I mean, come on.
They're not out sowing the seeds and reaping the harvest.
And you know, when you talk to teachers, they say that they have to spend the first month or so
just going back and reviewing. Yeah.
Yeah. So.
Okay. We will, I'm sure, be covering the education funding issue for weeks to come. And as someone who's been covering it for years, decades.
Watch what happens when they try to, there'll be some melding of the DeWine plan and the House plan. And it'll all be fascinating to see how they try to work it out.
The districts are going to, you know, school officials from around the state are going to be in the State House this week testifying before the committee, you know, giving their 2 cents on everything. So.
All right, Betsy in Delaware, thanks for that call. Appreciate it. And anyone else, 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. The first cannabis-infused products are set to hit the shelves around Ohio. Jackie Borchardt, you've been writing about this. This is a big deal. I mean, this is what Ohio is supposed to be offering. Is cannabis infused edibles?
Yeah, and the dried flower that they've been offering, all of those forms were approved in the law. It's not like what we've had so far was kind of a stopgap. It's just taken longer to get those processors online than was originally intended or hoped for, which is kind of the theme for the whole program. But but yeah, last week the first medical marijuana tinctures were sold at 3 dispensaries, and this week there's only 2 processors that have gotten the okay to make these products, such as tinctures and topical creams and patches, and what else is approved? Edibles. And so there's only 2 out of close to 40 that have their operations set up and are ready to go. And so the first one, Grow Ohio out in Zanesville, started with tinctures and shipped out their first shipment last week. They're going to ship out more this week to hopefully a wider net of dispensaries. But it's an option. Not everybody can or wants to vaporize dried marijuana. I talked with a woman a couple weeks ago with a rare disease who also has asthma. So vaping, smoking, mm-hmm. not an option for her.
Right.
But this is something that she would be able to take for some pain relief.
Anybody have any idea that they're getting a sense yet about what kind of revenue this is going to bring to the state?
Well, so it's a medical marijuana program. There's no additional state tax on this. There's sales tax,
right,
which is charged. And I don't have the numbers in front of me right now, but we're approaching, I think, $3 million in sales for the first 2.5 months,
right,
of this. And that's only with about a fourth of the state's dispensaries open. And up until 2 weeks ago, everything was in the eastern half of the state or northeastern part of the state. Columbus, Terrasana and Columbus opened 2 weeks ago, and that, I think, had a real positive impact because a lot of folks in Southwest Ohio, there's nothing open over there. There's no dispensaries open. So the closest to them now is, for a lot of folks like in Dayton, is Columbus. And a lot of people in Cincinnati were driving to Jackson, which, again, is not an easy drive. And especially if you, have a serious medical condition.
Mm-hmm. And you have to be the one to get it.
Well, you can designate a caregiver.
Okay.
But like this woman I was talking to a couple of weeks ago with the asthma, she has her husband or her partner is her caregiver. But if he goes, she still needs to find someone to stay there with her, so that, if she can't stay by herself.
Okay. Jackie, you also wrote about an investigation done by USA Today, the Arizona Republican, the Center for Public Integrity, that found that copycat bills from other states make their way to the Ohio State House through business interests, think tanks and organizations. And a lot of us have heard of
ALEC,
and the American Legislative Exchange Council, I think, is what it is. That's more familiar. It's funded by, I think, the Koch brothers, or
it's funded by a lot of businesses, okay, a lot of big mm-hmm. business,
conservative group,
and it definitely has a conservative bent. Some Democrats across the country belong to it, but it's very rare. It's mostly conservative, pro business type issues, and they actually on their website do have examples of their model bills. Mm-hmm. They're actually, I think, somewhat transparent in what they set out to do.
Mm-hmm.
It is interesting. I talked to some of our lawmakers here about some of these bills, and they either will say, "Oh, I didn't know it was an ALEC bill," or say something along the lines of, "It's a good idea to look and see what's out there and what has already kind of been through a legal hurdle and passed in another state,
mm-hmm.
Been successful elsewhere to get a starting point, but that everything that comes out of the legislature does have Ohio's stamp on it."
And a good example of a bill that Ohio sees that comes out of ALEC every year is bills that try to roll back or repeal Ohio's energy standards. It's something that started years ago with then-Senator Bill Seitz, a legislator from Cincinnati, who's
right.
a high-ranking official with ALEC.
Right.
And I think he was one of those people who had no problem saying, this is something that's been shopped around, for lack of a better phrase, nationwide. And it was something that represented what they believed to be the better interest for businesses. So rolling back the green energy standards to reduce the need to use or reduce the mandates or requirements to use wind energy, solar energy, energy efficiency programs. And so that's an example of an ALEC bill that Ohio sees almost every year.
But Ohio members of the Ohio General Assembly are influenced by lots of different groups. It's very rare that any kind of complex legislation is the brainchild of a legislator.
Yeah. And this database that my colleagues at USA Today, they spent 2 years putting it together, put a million bills from all 50 states into this computer algorithm that basically works like a plagiarism detector. It finds, combinations of words that no other explanation is that this you got this from somewhere else. And they only found 150 bills in Ohio, which is actually pretty small compared to other states. We're not one of the top five worst offenders of this. And I think, a big reason for that is that in Ohio, we have a full-time Legislative Service Commission, which is a nonpartisan agency that drafts the bills. And they also provide bill analysis throughout the process. And they make sure that whatever comes out of the General Assembly is crafted to fit in Ohio Revised Code, to work with Ohio's existing laws, and to do what the lawmakers intended it to do. And sometimes there are things that get through that process that need to be fixed later or changed, like we just saw with this gun thing a couple weeks ago in the late session, last session gun bill. But for the most part, I mean, that's kind of their job. And so a lawmaker will often – it's not like they take one of these model bills and then put their name on it and it starts going through the process. Mm-hmm. They may share that legislation with a Legislative Service Commission staffer, or they may just say that this is the idea I want to do. And so, they look for a way to write that bill. Or, they get it from industry who finds these bills through their connections. Mm-hmm. And so they may not know that it was an ALEC bill or through some other, think tank, but it was passed on to them from a constituent or from a business that they work with in their district.
Yeah, and I don't know how this compares, but there you also just have what you might call trendy bills where, that a legislator even says, hey, I saw a state like this passed this bill. Now I want to pass it too. A good example of that is the Stand Your Ground bill, which passed in Florida, I think 9 or 10 years ago now. And so other states, other conservatives in other states saw the Stand Your Ground bill in Florida and they said, oh, that's something that we would like too. And so then you start to see them. And that's why it kind of carries on the same name from state to state. The constitutional carry, or what other people call the permitless carry, the ability to carry a concealed weapon without a permit or without instruction. I think that started in Kansas. And, legislators from other states, including Ohio, I think also saw that and started saying, hey, I'd like that too.
Of course, the argument against using these model bills is, who are you serving here? Are you serving your constituents? Did your people who live in your district that you represent ask for these things? And in a lot of cases, that's not the case. And, like we saw last session with this bill to preempt, this leads into your next hour here, to preempt local ordinances putting a fee on plastic bags. Everyone was kind of confused at this because no community in Ohio has officially passed one of those ordinances.
It was preemptive.
It was a preemptive. And a lot of these preemptive things are model legislation.
That's all the time we have. Jackie Borchardt of the Cincinnati Inquirer, thanks for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
And Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch, thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
Andy Chow of Ohio Public Radio State House News Bureau, thanks to you.
Thanks, Ann.
And thanks to everybody else for listening. This has been All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.